This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated February 13th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's cover story of the Triangle Business Journal, Their Rules, Your Wallet. How crowdfunding could alter the playing field for Triangle investors and entrepreneurs. This week's lead cover story is written by Lauren Onisorge. She's entitled it, Crowdfunding's Role in a Tech-Friendly Environment. Durham entrepreneur Justin Beard says he's ready to scale. To do it, he needs cash. He's not eyeing a bank, he's eyeing your wallet. For decades, regulators have had strict rules in place to protect the assets of inexperienced investors. Only accredited investors have been allowed to take a startup bet, trading cash for equity. But the investor casino is changing in the United States. Across the country, 15 states now have rules in place that allow some form of crowdfunding, allowing entrepreneurs like Justin Beard to appeal to the masses and not just traditional investors with their pitch decks. A bill sponsored by Representative Brian Brown and Representative Robert Bryan, now circulating in the General Assembly, could bring North Carolina into that group. But with the reward potential comes hefty risks. Risk so great that the House's version of the bill requires investors to write the exact words, I am investing in a high-risk, speculative business venture. I may lose all of my investment, and I can afford the loss of my investment. End quote. The vast majority of entrepreneurs and investors say they agree that crowdfunding should and will happen. A measure that failed to pass on Jones Street last year has a new ally this time around. Newly tapped North Carolina Secretary of Commerce, John Sclavara. He's quoted as saying, at the end of the day, unless you've got a rich uncle, small businesses have a whole lot of difficulty raising money. And $250,000 to an early stage business, it's that little boost they need to get over the top. He says, and adding that crowdfunding could be the most important opportunity for small businesses in the state of North Carolina that we've ever had. There will be winners and losers in crowdfunding legislation. As the majority of startup ventures fail, some fear the losses will stack up, leaving legislatures revising the measure multiple times before the right formula becomes law. It's going to work out eventually, predicts Lookout Capital Managing Director Merritt Moore. There are probably going to be two or three incarnations of it before someone discovers how to do it the right way. Beard's company, Durham-based Snap Yeti, develops photo contests aiming to capitalize on consumers' love of selfies, all to promote companies like BoardMe and Disney-owned ABC 11. More than 160 businesses have created contests, with 90% indicating they're going to do another one in the next 6 months. In March, he's planning to solicit a $600,000 fundraiser, but connecting with investors takes time, and the opportunities are happening now. Beard has embarked on a $100,000 bridge loan fundraiser. And to execute on that, he plans to appeal to the masses, literally. He's signing on with a brand new Raleigh-based platform, Malartu Funds. When Malartu Funds launches in the next several weeks, says Malartu co-founder Sean Steigerwald, he plans to list an offering. So does Aaron Denon, founder of Rocketbolt, a technology that aims to help salespeople do their jobs better. Wouldn't you rather have 5,000 really interested salespeople who really want your product funding you versus two people who are vaguely aware of your area but wouldn't use your product every day, he says, adding that by crowdfunding he can reach a greater volume of people in his industry for feedback purposes. Right now, the offerings will only be available to accredited investors. But the yet-to-be-passed legislation would allow anyone, regardless of pay scale, to invest up to $2,000 in a venture in North Carolina. Steigerwald is watching the legislation closely. His company's entire premise is crowdfunding. Malar 2 Funds, which is billed as an online marketplace for crowdfunding opportunities, has yet to make its debut. And already, four companies are committed to raising cash on the site, with more than a dozen in the pipeline. If the measure passes, anyone will be able to log on to the website and see general descriptions of a business. Maybe a couple of bullet points about each one, maybe a video, Steigerwald notes. Otherwise, the platform will only be open to people already investing in companies, accredited investors, folks who, according to the Securities Act of 1933, must be individuals or married couples with a joint net worth that exceeds $1 million, excluding the value of their homes, or a person with an income exceeding $200,000 in each of the two most recent years. Married couples' joint income must exceed $300,000 for those years, with a reasonable expectation to make the same sum this year. The theory is that the estimated 8.7% of households that fall under the designation have money to lose. Steigerwald is one of many entrepreneurs creating a vehicle. One fear that's repeated is that an entrepreneur with a flashy commercial budget will create a spectacular video and lure in investment, only to bolt with the cash and never execute the invention. Steigerwald says his team does due diligence on its companies. But Sklavara points out that any time you deal with strangers, there are risks. He says, if I needed to raise $1 million, I wouldn't go to the internet. I'd go to people I know. That in itself mitigates a lot of the risks. End quote. Another limitation on risk is a cap on the investment at $2,000. Generally, people that are going to invest in something are not going to ruin their lives over $2,000, Sklavara adds. To a traditional investor, the sum may seem like pocket change, but one reason not all accredited investors are attracted to a site like Malar 2. Our investors, they just don't want to write a check for $2,000 as an investment, says Moore, who manages Lookout Capital's team of investors, recalling a round several years ago where, after rationing the stake, he found it difficult to get investors to write commitments for $20,000. Obviously, that's a problem only certain folks will have. But it's the other group that's generating the most paranoia among bill watchers, those who may not be able to afford that check but write it anyway. Part of the bill's success will depend on investors' understanding that startups are gambles, no matter how experienced the investor, says angel investor Alex Osadsky, a former partner at Trinity Ventures. Most startups fail, and that's the reality. Entrepreneurs will present plans that are optimistic, he says. You can't present a plan that says you'll go out of business. And reality often fails to meet the expectation. It's the exceptional company that meets the expectations. I hope that this is done carefully enough that small investors aren't disappointed, he says. Across the country, caps have been handled in several different ways. In Georgia, unaccredited investors can funnel up to $10,000 in companies, for example. In Washington, unaccredited investors can invest up to $2,000 or 5% of their paycheck, whichever sum is greater. Even if the company succeeds long enough to make it a larger funding round, think millions. That's $2,000 cap could create additional problems. Odzinski's has investing agreements require pro rata rights to invest in future rounds to maintain his equity stake, something he's exercised in all of his portfolio companies. If the company raises money later, if the investor doesn't want to get diluted for the investor, may need to write a bigger check, and that may be a check that's bigger than what's possible under the Act, he says. Crowdfunding advocate and angel investor Mark Easley points out that, as the bill is written, the cap only applies for a 12-month period, meaning a company can have an offering every year, and unaccredited investors can continue to invest. An additional crowdfunding offering in year two could be targeted to only existing non-accredited investors, he says. Many investors could care less about the pro rata dilution as long as the valuation of the company continues to improve with each round until exit, Easley says. Their existing shares are getting more valuable and they are not committing more money at a higher price. He compares it to buying Apple at $10 and holding on to the stock instead of buying more shares every time the price goes up $20. Both ways make money, but the newest shares make a lot less money and still concentrate more risk in Apple, he says. Some fear embarking on crowdfunding could turn off the venture capitalists that could someday pour millions into a company's ventures. Some big decisions made by a corporation require shareholder votes. That could be an administrative aggravation if it meant rounding up 100 strangers, fears Moore. We have over 70 investors now, and they're all folks we know very well and have great relationships with, and they trust us. It can still be a nightmare to deal with that many people, he says. Think about 200 or 100 people that don't know each other. Easley says most crowdfunding offerings would be structured as special purpose limited liability corporations, where crowdfunders would invest in the LLC, which would then invest in the company, a standard on sites such as Crowdfunder. Decisions on pro rata rights and preferred stock would be made by that LLC based on what would work best for a successful fundraising campaign. The terms of the offerings and the offering documents will be available to the potential investors to review as part of the crowdfunding campaign, he says. Another concern exists among investors: disclosure requirements. Private companies do not have to disclose their revenue and business transactions and often cite competitive concerns when asked why they keep their financial details close to the vest. But the bill would require that they disclose their business plans to potential non-accredited investors, meaning a company's business plan with future revenue and expenses may not stay a secret. Investors need to know all of the facts, points out Cary-based angel investor David Gardner. So if a company is in stealth mode or trying to keep some information off the radar, then this type of funding may not be a good fit for them. Gardner's biggest concern is that entrepreneurs will leapfrog the traditional system, where a founding team finds sophisticated investors that tell them no and then explain why. This is a very valuable process necessary for perfecting a startup's offering and proposed business model, Gardner says. Fundraising is a precious opportunity to align the advisors, key customers, and strategic partners to your cause. Too often, first-time entrepreneurs think it's all just about raising the money as quickly as they can from anyone who will give it to them. And that would be a very bad way to utilize the tool, he says. But if used correctly, and it's Gardner's take that it should be used after that initial sophisticated investor is signed on, it could be a valuable capitalization tool. Will 2015 be the year? Easley points out that North Carolina does have one big advantage over other states that have already initiated the measure. We now have lots of experience and successful models to look at that have happened over the last 2 years, he says. Now it's up to the legislature to put that experience into practice. I actually think when our legislation finally goes through that it will be a leader in the nation in terms of actually putting a crowdfunding bill forth that people will be more willing to utilize and exercise on, says bill sponsor Representative Rob Bryan. But not all entrepreneurs are willing to wait on lawmakers. Groundfloor, a Raleigh-based crowd lending platform, packed up shop and moved to Atlanta last year as legislatures stalled on the bill. Millar 2 founder Steigerwald has said he's considering it as well, but the support of his investors, such as Easley, has kept him and his plan in Raleigh. We're launching in a couple of weeks, no matter what, says Steigerwald. By the numbers, the estimated number of active crowdfunding platforms worldwide. In 2010, there were 283. In 2011, there were 434 crowdfunding platforms. And in 2012, there were 536 active crowdfunding platforms worldwide. The estimated volume of funds raised by crowdfunding platforms worldwide was, in 2011, $1.5 billion, in 2012, $2.7 billion, And the estimated volume of funds raised by crowdfunding platforms worldwide in 2013 was $5.1 billion. What follows are four vignettes of They Said It concerning crowdfunding and investing. Angel and venture capital investors speak out about the pros and cons of crowdfunding. Triangle investors all seem to agree that the investment world needs a wider window and that crowdfunding should be embraced, but concerns exist. Mr. David Gardner, an angel investor in Cary, is quoted as saying, "I'm all for any process that can get North Carolina entrepreneurs the capital that is so desperately lacking in our state. But personally, I think some of the possible downsides. If a company already has a lead sophisticated investor in place who has vetted the company extensively, then finishing the round out via crowdfunding can work great. However, I hope that crowdfunding won't ever be used to circumvent that process." Mr. Alex Osadinsky, who's a Cary-based angel investor, is quoted as saying, "I do think democratizing investing and opening up the ability for investors, smaller investors, not accredited investors, to put some money into entrepreneurs and startups is a good idea. I am concerned that, despite all of the warnings, all of the stuff you have to sign, that you may lose all your money despite all of that, people get disappointed." And Mr. Mark Easley, a Morrisville angel investor and crowdfunding advocate, is quoted as saying, "The best way for a startup to evaluate this is to go to the popular investment crowdfunding sites and study the successful campaigns of others. Some of my favorite sites that I belong to and which have excellent educational material include AngelList.com, Crowdfunder.com, EquityNet.com, Fundable.com, FundersClub.com, and WeFunder.com. And finally, Jason Kaplan, venture capitalist at Bull City Venture Partners, is quoted as saying, "Crowdfunding as a funding vehicle is a good and reasonable structure for some types of projects. However, it may not be the best for companies that are going to be raising larger later rounds of venture capital or equity financing, primarily due to the control issues, and you might end up with hundreds of very small investors, and venture capitalists do not want that aggravation." Excuse me, that previous quote was by Scott Albert, who is a venture partner at Durham-based The Aurora Funds. Next up, Amanda Hoyle. Amanda covers commercial and residential real estate transactions. She says that the Triangle rents are going to spike 7%. Low vacancy rates give commercial landlords an edge. After more than 5 years of stagnant office rents and concessions that put tenant companies in control of how much they were willing to pay for office space in the Triangle, the tables have now turned. Average rental rates for Class A space in the Triangle increased 3.3% to around $22.23 per square foot per year in 2014, and in 2015, the price hike in office rents is expected to more than double with another 7% increase, according to a report from the Avison Young commercial real estate firm. For a company leasing 10,000 square feet in a Class A office building, that increase amounts to another $15,600 per year in rent. Owners and landlords of Class A office space across the market are able to raise their rental rates primarily because the vacancy rate for Class A space in the region is at its lowest level in the past 15 years. It is 8.9%. Tenants don't have as many choices for vacancy space as they used to. Plus, construction material and labor costs for new buildings continues to rise, and those extra costs are also being reflected in higher rental rates among new buildings underway. Rental rates for the new Class A office building currently under construction in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties range from $24 per square foot at Duke Realty's Perimeter 4 building in Morrisville to $34.50 per square foot in the 123 West Franklin, former University Square, in Chapel Hill. Also under Amanda Hoyle's column lead, McCrory's Project Phoenix could pump $1.4 billion into state building projects. Governor Pat McCrory, in his State of the State speech on February 4th, issued a call to arms to the state's General Assembly leadership, asking for permission to issue $1.2 billion to $1.4 billion in bond funds in 2015 to begin fixing the nearly $4 billion in building deficiencies the state is facing in its own building portfolio. The general bond proposal, which McCrory has dubbed Project Phoenix, would be more money than the state has spent on repair and renovation to state-owned buildings in the last 10 years combined. According to a state construction office report in 2013, North Carolina is facing more than $3.9 billion in building deficiencies statewide due to deferred maintenance and repair issues, much of that among the state government's downtown complex in Raleigh. From 2004 to 2014, the General Assembly allocated a total of $986.5 million towards building repairs and renovations, with the money being split nearly equally between the state agency buildings and the University of North Carolina-owned campus buildings, according to state documents. We now move to Jason DeBruin's column on healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. His lead article is UNC Spinout Snags $33 Million for Cancer Treatment. UNC Chapel Hill Spinout G1 Therapeutics is becoming a darling in the Triangle's pharma scene. About a year after it raised $12.5 million, it announced on February 5th that it raised another $33 million, including from Eichelman Ventures, the investment fund founded by one of the most successful people in the Triangle pharmaceutical space, Fred Eichelman. Not only that, but Boston-based life sciences investment group RA Capital Management actually reached out through G1's website to inquire about investing in the company, a nearly unheard-of scenario in drug investment, an industry that nearly always sees drug developers touring the country in search of money. "It's the first time I've ever heard of it," says Chrissy Schaefer, managing director of Hatteras Discovery and venture partner with Hatteras Venture Partners, a Durham-based life sciences investment group. Hatteras first invested $600,000 with G1 back in 2012 and have stayed with the company since then. "We bet on the concept and we bet on the people involved," Schaefer said. "Really great science coupled with really good people." G1 scientists, which include Dr. Norman Sharpless, director of the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, think they found a way to manipulate the cell cycle to protect bone marrow during chemotherapy treatments. When treating cancer, chemotherapy will kill a tumor, but also will often kill many of the healthy cells in a body. G1's intravenous drug would pause the cell cycle at a point where the cells naturally have a very strong defense shield and can withstand chemotherapy treatments on their own. If G1 can successfully prove this therapy, it could become a breakthrough in cancer treatments, as it would allow doctors to administer chemotherapy to kill a tumor, but still protect healthy bone marrow. G1 is developing this IV therapy in patients with small cell lung cancer. It will also work on a pill to treat a different kind of cancer through therapy that works to shrink a tumor. So far, G1 has tested the drugs in healthy humans called a Phase 1A trial. With the infusion of cash, G1 will test the products in cancer patients beginning this summer for the IV drug and later this year for the pill. "The exciting part will be when we start dosing patients," says Mark Valleca, G1's chief executive. In addition to his investment, Eichelman agreed to join the G1 board. "Just the experience that he has in drug development is unparalleled," says Valleca. "The fact that he's local is just great for the ecosystem." Eichelman founded PPD, a pharmaceutical research company, and Furiex, a drug developer, both of which, were later sold. "I'm delighted to be involved with a growing company that originated from the University of North Carolina," says Eichelman, himself a graduate of the UNC School of Pharmacy, a school that bears his name and to which he has committed more than $100 million in donations. G1's strong leadership team, seasoned advisors, and pipeline of proprietary drug candidates position the company to be a key player in oncology. Valleca says it's now up to him and his team to bring a return on that $33 million. It's all about execution at this point, he says. ACA by the numbers, 60,182. That's how many people in Raleigh have health insurance coverage through Affordable Care Act marketplace plans. That represents about 13% of the 479,748 in North Carolina who selected plans, according to new data released from the Obama administration. Health and Human Service Secretary Sylvia Burwell visited Alliance Medical Ministry in Raleigh on February 6th to discover the enrollment so far and encourage those who haven't signed up to choose a plan. A geographic breakdown of those who have signed up for a plan in North Carolina is as follows. 122,837 consumers are in Charlotte and the Concord and Gastonia area. 60,182 are consumers in Raleigh. In the Greensboro High Point area, there are 38,747 consumers and 53,801 consumers in the Virginia Beach, Norfolk, Newport News area. News in the pharma world. Quintile founder Dennis Gillings will step down from his role as the company's board chairman, but he still holds a significant portion of the company. He recently sold $437 million in stock, but still holds nearly 18.2 million shares, valued at more than $1 billion, according to FactSet Research Systems, which tracks public company shareholders. The change will become effective at the end of 2015, and he will remain as a director on the board. The move comes as a continuation of what began in April 2012, when Quintiles hired Tom Pike as the company's chief executive. Since the initial public offering in 2013 that raised $490 million for Quintiles, Gillings and other major shareholders have been cashing out their stock. Gillings sold $207 million in shares in March and another $230 million shares in November. You should know that WakeMed Health and Hospitals posted a $3 million first quarter operating income and just announced it took its new electronic health record system live. Financial results for WakeMed's first quarter of fiscal 2015 was from October to December of 2014. They announced $269 million in total revenue, $3.3 million in operating income, and $7.1 million of net income. Lauren Onisorge, that covers technology and entrepreneurship, has been busy this week. She's learned that there's a new home for HQ Raleigh, a co-working space to take over a former furniture factory. First American Underground, then HQ Raleigh. Triangle co-working spaces are expanding. HQ Raleigh is the latest to announce a growth plan, its co-founders having just purchased what used to be the William Cozart Furniture Production Facility on West Street in downtown Raleigh. The building, comprising 10,000 square feet behind HQ's existing headquarters on Harrington Street, will be redeveloped into 30,000 to 50,000 square feet of space that will include offices for larger startup teams as well as meeting space. The building will end up being a two- or three-story structure once complete. The new annex, located at 319 West Street, has an anticipated opening date of spring 2016. The purchase price was $900,000, according to Wake County deed records. The assessed value of the land and existing building is listed at $276,970. The co-founders, Brooke Bells, Jesse Lipson, Christopher Gergen, and Jason Wyden, plan to emphasize flexibility both in design and in lease terms. From our experience, most commercial real estate rarely gets the unique space and community needs of a fast-growth entrepreneur, says Bell, referring to long-term leases and closed-off spaces HQ tries to avoid. HQ Raleigh, which moved into its current space last year, hosts more than 105 startups in downtown Raleigh and has an office suite waiting list of more than 15 companies. And it's continuing a trend. American Underground completes its latest expansion to additional floors at its Main Street facility this week. Companies have already started to move in to the new wings. Also on Startups and Real Estate, Reverb Nation spin out AdWorks. Real Estate is just the beginning. AdWorks, which spun out of Durham-based Reverb Nation, just closed on $1.2 million in its first funding round, according to a securities filing. And while Real Estate is its sweet spot, its top exec says moves are already being made to explore other verticals. As the story goes, AdWorks is an extension of a product we built for the music industry inside of Reverb Nation in 2010, says Jed Carlson, CEO of the new firm. 2 years ago, we decided to take a big step and start an experiment in taking that product outside music. For the past year, the company has been preparing for that separation, with Reverb Nation keeping the music application of the technology and AdWorks bringing it to other industries, starting with real estate. We use big data to identify the people in any given zip code in the U.S. who are in the market for real estate, he says. We identify them with their browsing behavior. It may start when someone simply researches moving companies online. We follow that individual around the web with ads for an agent, he says. It's a wide net of viewers when you're only trying to reach a select group of people, such as home buyers. With the internet, we can take that group of 10,000 people that live in the average zip code and actually whittle it down to those in the real estate market, he says. Citrix jobs cuts have minimal impact in Raleigh. There's good news for Citrix employees in Raleigh. A bullish restructuring plan that means 900 employee cuts across the country isn't going to pack a punch on its growing Triangle workforce. Only 5 Raleigh employees were impacted, the company confirms. Additionally, Citrix local workforce continues to hire for its 500-plus headcount downtown. There was an emerging issues forum in downtown Raleigh. Did you know about it? Well, several people were there and spoke their minds. Janet Cowell is quoted as saying, "I know there is still a greater need than what the Innovation Fund is able to provide." Jeffrey Lacker, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, was quoted as saying, "We are failing to keep pace with our economy's growing demand for skilled workers." And Dan Tapscott, best-selling author of The Digital Revolution, was heard saying, "I was an authority on model trains when I was 11. Today, 11-year-olds are the authority on the digital revolution." Mr. Jim Goodnight, the CEO of SAS, is quoted as saying, "The state needs to find ways to maybe give differentiated pay to our STEM teachers so we can attract and retain our STEM teachers." And Robert Atkinson, president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, was quoted, "If we kept the same share of government spending in R&D to the economy that we had in the 1960s, North Carolina would be getting $4 billion a year from the feds more than you get today." And Bob Ingram, partner at Hatteras Venture Partners, was overheard, "The whole life science sector is undergoing, in my opinion, a real revolution on how we do R&D. Big companies have changed. They go outside to the universities. They go outside to startups. But more and more, they also share." This week's executive voice is Beth Wood. Ms. Wood is the North Carolina State Auditor, and she loves to dance. She's known as being the watchdog of taxpayer funds. North Carolina runs a massive government with many moving parts and billions of tax dollars. In an attempt to keep each state department honest, Auditor Beth Wood and her team provide objective information to interested parties about whether $46 billion in state assets are properly accounted for, reported, and managed. Triangle Business Journal. What's it like being the state auditor? Mrs. Wood. It's a big responsibility. I know that this office is responsible for keeping an eye on state government and making sure tax dollars are being spent properly. TBJ. What is your daily routine like? Mrs. Wood. I usually wake up about 6:30 or 7 and start with a workout, either on the treadmill or lifting weights, and then I come to the office and read the news to see if there is anything that we should be looking at. After that, it's a lot of meetings and speaking engagements or teaching. I love to teach. TBJ, how do you decide to initiate an audit? Mrs. Wood. There are a couple of different ways. We have the routine audits, of course, like the annual financial audits on the public universities, for example. Then there are legislatures who sometimes ask us to look into something for them. But we rely heavily on our teams within the auditor's office to keep their eyes and ears open on things we should be paying attention to. We also listen to the public. I speak at a lot of Rotary or Kiwanis clubs, and we hear things that people are dealing with. For example, I kept hearing how hard it was for people to get permits from DENR, the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources. They could not find out the status of their applications, but yet DENR reports to the legislature stated that permits were issued in accordance with statute requirements. As it turns out, there was a discrepancy in the way things were being recorded and how they were being reported. So we investigated that and brought that to light. TBJ, what was the toughest audit you have had to do? Mrs. Wood, Medicaid. It's such a big program. That one took a lot of time and energy, but it was one the legislature needed to know about. TBJ, along the same lines, what audit has given you the most satisfaction? Mrs. Wood, I would say Medicaid again. It's a program that disperses $12 or $13 billion in taxes, including $3 billion from the state. When we turned that into the General Assembly, it was a big sense of accomplishment. TBJ, being an auditor, I can imagine you don't make too many friends. Mrs. Wood, in some cases, secretaries of some departments don't like when we come to look at them. But take Secretary Waz, Aldana Waz, Secretary of North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. She and I were just at an event together this morning. She understands that she has a job to do, and I have a job to do, and we keep our professional lives professional. TBJ, at what point do you personally get involved with an audit? Mrs. Wood, early after my staff has gone on a fact-finding mission and has laid out some objectives. We usually have a meeting and talk about what we want to accomplish with this audit. Then again, when an audit is about 75% completed. At that point, my staff brings to me the preliminary findings and we talk about what the report will look like. I like to bring in a cold eye and play the devil's advocate at that point. Then we decide what needs to happen to get the rest of the 25% done. TBJ, what would you say your management style is like? Mrs. Woods, I like to be hands-off. I expect that everyone I hire is capable of doing their jobs. I'm here as a resource. I'm here as a way to open doors if you need it, but I expect you to be able to do the work I hired you to do. TBJ, tell us about your roots. Mrs. Wood, I grew up on a farm near New Bern, humble, some might even call it poor. After high school, I became a dental hygienist, but there are only so many teeth you can scrape. Math had always been a favorite subject of mine, so I took some credits I had earned at Wayne Community College and transferred to East Carolina University. From there, I worked in corporate America before coming back to this office as an employee. Back in 2007, I decided I wanted to run for state auditor, so that's what I did in 2008, and here I am. TBJ, what are some of your hobbies? Mrs. Wood, I love to shag. My husband actually teaches shag. He's a great dancer. One of my favorite things to do is to drink a glass of wine and go dancing with my husband. TBJ, finish this sentence. I'm happiest when... Mrs. Woods, I'm with my family. My husband smiles all the time. Well, he smiled a lot before we were married, so I don't think it's because of me. I like to visit my family in New Bern. When both my parents were alive, we got together at least once a month. Now that they've passed, we get together about 4 or 5 times a year, but I miss them. I don't have any children, but I spoil my nieces and nephews. I'm their favorite aunt. TBJ, UNC, NC State, or Duke? Mrs. Woods, well, I'm a Pirate first and foremost. After that, it's NC State. My mother-in-law worked in the athletics department for years, and she still has seats right behind the bench. During basketball games, you can find me with my feet up on the back row of the bench, and we get some pretty good football tickets as well. Next up, small business, family business. This column is written by James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and is a family business speaker and author. This week's column is entitled, Documentation Can Save a Business Time and Money. My friend Judy describes her days working in the press room of a major newspaper. When the big presses were running, she recalls, the noise was so loud that anything you wanted to tell anyone had to be written down. We wore earplugs and carried little clipboards with pencils attached. If it wasn't written down, it never happened. Judy's recollection underscores a crucial point for family-owned and other closely held businesses. If it's not documented, written down on paper, or in the computer, there's no way to be sure that it did happen. It is happening, or it will happen. Any decision, plan, or action of business importance should be documented. Consider this scenario. The president needs a short meeting of the company's four senior managers to review some changes in a major project plan. He tells his assistant to contact the managers and set it up. The assistant calls out to one of the managers, the president's daughter, as she walks down the hall, meeting in the conference room at 3 p.m., pass it on. That manager runs into another manager in the copier room. Did you hear about the meeting this afternoon? I think it's in the conference room. Tell the others, will you? The second manager gets on a series of conference calls and doesn't tell anyone about the meeting. At 3:10 p.m., the president and one manager are waiting in the conference room when another manager wanders in. Oh, there you are, he says. Nobody told me where the meeting would be held. The two other senior managers, sons of the family, are rounded up and the meeting begins at 3:35. The president takes another 20 minutes to explain product changes and to list the decisions that have to be made. The meeting is hardly a picture of efficiency. A lot of, I thought we'd already decided that, and who gave you those estimates anyway, get tossed around. It's after 5 p.m. when the president announces that they've done enough work on the project for now and adjourns the meeting. As he prepares to call the client the following Friday, he realizes that the only record of the meeting is what he remembers of the decision and the decisions made. The senior managers don't all agree with his recollections. He has to hold another meeting. If this scenario is uncomfortably familiar, a little constructive analysis might be helpful. To begin, an assistant should arrange a manager's meeting with a memo or an email notice, not a shout down the hall. But that sort of thinking often flows down from the top. The president was remiss in not preparing an agenda, even a sketchy one that listed the points for discussion and copying it to the managers. The agenda would let them get their notes and thoughts together to make the best use of time. Speaking of notes, the gathering was doomed to be wasteful when nobody was appointed to take notes of who said what on what subject and what was decided. The notes should be copied to the meeting participants and added to the project file. Cleaned up and neatly formatted, they could even be sent to the client as work product. Here's the difference documentation makes. The meeting would have started promptly at 3 p.m. if a real notice had been distributed. The senior managers would have come prepared to work if an agenda had tipped them off to what issues were on the table. If notes of this meeting were kept, the points discussed, decisions made, and actions launched would be clear and available to everyone affected. The whole business could have been concluded in an hour or less. Most family businesses work hard and try to work smart, too. Documenting business, writing it down, is a smart way to work. This week, Cameron Sipes has a special column. It's about Mr. J.R. Sharon, and he says he's had a good run. Ask Deloitte's Raleigh Managing Director and Financial Services veteran, J.R. Sharon, what advice he'd give to a person who's just beginning to build his career in the accounting profession, and he offers a very simple answer. It's the same I give people all along, Sharon says. When you decide where you're going to work, make sure it's a group of people you want to be around. To Sharon, it's about being able to look back on your life and career, coming up with no feelings of contrition. I've honestly had no regrets, he said. I've had a good run thus far. That good run for Sharon began in 1981 when he joined Price Waterhouse, now Price Waterhouse Coopers, fresh out of NC State University. He served in an auditing role for a couple of years before delving into the firm's tax function for another few years, all in the firm's Raleigh office. After about 7 years at Pricewaterhouse, Sharon went to work for one of his largest clients at the time, Carolina Builders. That was in the mid to late 1980s, not the best time to be in the construction industry. Sharon performed finance work and tax return duties for CBC founder Cliff Benson for a few years before the work ran out. When his business focus changed, Cliff didn't have much left for me to do, Sharon says. In December 1989, Sharon joined his current employer, Deloitte, as a tax manager in the firm's Raleigh office. And for about 4 years later, he was named a partner in the firm. Throughout his career at Deloitte, Sharon has served in a number of roles, including tax manager and his current role as Raleigh Managing Director, where he oversees all financial services functions of Deloitte's 226-person Capital City office. He's been in that particular role since June 2000. In his nearly 35-year career, Sharon can proudly say he spent all of it in Raleigh, and as such, he's been able to plant deep roots of his own here and has been able to give back to the community that he calls home. One major way Sharon's been able to give back is through his involvement with the United Way of the Greater Triangle. He's served on the board for the better part of the last decade and as board chair for the past 2 years. JR was instrumental in developing and articulating the evolving role of United Way, says United Way's president and CEO, Mac Kuntz. As board chair, he challenged us to find ways that complement our role as a funder, to mobilize our community to address social issues. His reserved demeanor belies his ardent commitment to driving change. One who leads by example, he is a strong advocate for our work, says Kuntz. What's the most fun part about being J.R. Sharon, the professional? Sharon says being able to represent firms in the marketplace not only around growing the business, but the things we do in the community. All of the professional accomplishments aside, Sharon points to his family as his greatest achievement. It's been my family and being able to help them succeed, he says. Laurie Ornisorge has a column about auditing. Are you worried about an audit? Well, watch out for the red flags. When it comes to cheating Uncle Sam, a few go to great lengths to game the system. Consider the case of Thayer Alwan and Sahil Fadhil, owners of Raleigh's area I Love New York pizza stores, who pleaded guilty in July to charges that they willfully filed false federal income tax returns, skimming nearly all of their company's cash receipts. In the $1.34 million sifted from sales was used for personal expenses or deposited into the owner's personal bank accounts, according to court documents. Or Tasha Renee Smith, a Durham tax preparer, sentenced to 30 months in prison last August for a scheme that involved, according to court records, adding false dependents to tax returns at her Durham business, nothing but taxes. But typically, blunders are far more innocent. And with some attention to detail and good advice, those mistakes and the resulting audit can be avoided. Larry Hamilton, a certified public accountant with Hughes, Pittman, and Gupton in Raleigh, says the most common mistake he sees is filers failing to adequately match forms. It's failing to report things that have already been reported to the IRS on information returns, he says, using alimony payments as an example. If one side reports receiving alimony, the other side needs to report paying it, and vice versa. Other blunders that will score an audit are failing to follow filing requirements in other states and failing to report foreign bank accounts. And watch your home office deductions because the IRS will be watching them, especially if you're taking large home office deductions, says Hamilton. Another common pay point, hobby losses. If you're trying to deduct losses from horses, for example, you need to be making money from your equestrian endeavors. Some people try to do it, he says. Inexperience, too, can put filers at a disadvantage. Corey Skolnick of Raleigh-based Skolnick CPA says entrepreneurs leaving large corporations to start their own ventures tend to make rookie mistakes. The biggest issue they tend to have is they don't know how to set aside their money properly, he says, pointing to the two pools they need to set aside, income tax and self-employment tax. Everyone understands the income tax, but as an independent contractor, you have to make sure you're setting aside enough money for self-employment tax, too. Hamilton's advice is to talk to an accountant early in the endeavor so as not to be caught unaware in April. Mark Hansen, spokesperson for the Internal Revenue Service, has a checklist of common mistakes, everything from making sure you have the correct postage to entering your income on the correct line. Hamilton recommends filing electronically because there's some checks on the electronic filing that catch things before the returns are actually even filed with the IRS. It simplifies the entire process, he says. And here are the latest informations by the numbers about taxes and audits. 6.7 million total tax returns filed in North Carolina for fiscal 2013. 4.3 million total returns filed electronically in North Carolina. 3.5 million total number of refunds issued in North Carolina. The total refund amount in North Carolina was $9.5 billion. $66.1 billion were total returns filed electronically in North Carolina. And $7 billion were business income taxes in North Carolina. And it's getting a little less painful. The number of audits in the United States in 2012 was 1.5 million. In 2013, it was 1.4 million. This week's Viewpoint page, The Editor's Notebook, is written by Sukadar Mukherjee. He is the editor of Triangle Business Journal. His column is entitled, Crowdfunding Move Needs Due Diligence. We have been poring over the content of the crowdfunding bill that is currently in front of North Carolina lawmakers. Coupled with Governor Pat McCrory's insistence that a crowdfunding mechanism is good for entrepreneurs and innovation in North Carolina, the momentum is on the right side for these lawmakers and proponents of the bill. Essentially, the crowdfunding bill allows anyone to invest in startups by investing in as much as $2,000 for each venture. Direct private investments are really not possible under existing laws unless the person is an accredited investor, meaning the individual's net worth must be more than $1 million before he or she can invest in companies. So, here is my analysis. First, have a crowdfunding law is a good idea. If North Carolina were to become a state known for its innovation, entrepreneurship, and smart people, the democratization of investing makes sense. Wealth can grow across various socioeconomic sectors without worrying about widening the wealth gap. But we also understand what we are dealing with here. Startups and entrepreneurs can pitch for money to anyone and perhaps make promises that simply are not attainable. Therefore, these entrepreneurs must be told that their business plans, perhaps without divulging the intellectual property, must be public, and whatever is in those publicly available documents is what they can pitch to potential investors. Second, currently, beyond family and friends, angels and venture capital firms currently owning the investing ecosystem in the startup space. We have to make sure that we do not make the system difficult for them to be interested. For example, if 50 people decided to pour $2,000 into a startup for equity, and that startup hits all its milestones to be able to raise $2 million in the next round, these 50 individuals need to know their shareholder ownership rights without ambiguity. If a company suddenly has 50 bosses and all of them want different things, that company can forget about being funded by an accredited investor. Roles, rules, and rights of this process should be litigation-proof. And finally, before any such bill is passed, lawmakers should bring in entrepreneurs and make them the central part of the discussion. Not to mention, as our centerpiece story on page one has mentioned, 15 states already have some form of crowdfunding rules. Let's see what is working and what is not. Overall, I'm glad we're having this conversation on Jones Street. If done properly, the bill offers promise and opportunities. Also, did you know that the 2015 Ethics Bowl was held at Campbell Law School in downtown Raleigh? Triangle Business Journal was invited to be a judge at this year's Ethics Bowl organized by the North Carolina Independent Colleges and Universities, which represents the state's 36 independent colleges and its 68,000 students. The focus of this year's competition was Ethics in Education. Students from 20 colleges were given case reports, after which they had to debate on individual scenarios from various cases. Armed with smart students, the arguments were mostly concise, succinct, and thoughtful. Triangle Business Journal left the competition thinking North Carolina's future leaders will be bringing new skill sets to the table as they lead our municipalities, state, and the nation. Students from Wake Forest University won the competition, edging out Barton College for the title. The Triangle Business Journal's only wish, after having judged this competition for 3 years, Duke University and Elon University need to send teams to this growing event, which not only benefits academic institutions, but expands our diversity of thought. The NCICU lead, A. Hope Williams, and her team, we say, keep challenging these students. Job well done. There is a Carolina Ballet dancer is to open a school. Lauren O'Brien, a principal dancer with the Carolina Ballet, has signed an agreement to open the first tutu school franchise outside of California, with a new location opening in downtown Raleigh in the spring. The tutu school is a boutique ballet program for toddlers and children, and in Raleigh. It will be the first retail tenant in the new Devon 425 apartment and retail building on 425 North Boland Avenue in the Glenwood South District. Christina Coffey of CBRE Raleigh represented the tutu school in the lease transaction. O'Brien has been a dancer with Carolina Ballet since 2001 and a principal with the Raleigh-based dance company since 2011. She grew up in Crystal Lake, Illinois, outside Chicago. She began dancing at age 8 and trained at the School of Ballet Chicago and the School of American Ballet in New York City. Glenn White, owner of Complete Construction Company in Apex, is the new president of the board for the Home Builders Association of Raleigh-Wake County. But White's goals while in office go beyond boosting membership. This year, White, a leader for many years within the HBA's Remodelers Council, is creating a Young Professionals Committee that he wants to use to help boost mentorship and education for the next generation of home builders. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.